This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Stephen Pope, Editor-in-Chief of Flying Magazine. Steve's knowledge of aviation runs deep. In the news, we look at United Airlines computer problems, tracking passengers moving through the airport, the search for MH370 concludes, ADS-B-capable satellites, the latest Mitsubishi MRJ delay, B-2 bombers fly a 30-hour mission, testing tilt rotors, a possible lead on D.B. Cooper, and a tribute to Gene Cernan. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 436 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. In this episode, we have the full complement of co-hosts. We'll start off first by introducing, well, the other Max, Max Trescott. He's a CFI and author and our resident glass cockpit expert. Max Trescott, how are you?
Wow, since we have everybody here, I'll keep it short. I'm great. How you doing?
Good, good. We're expecting an ice storm here. So, guys, if the power goes out, well, the show will be over. Hopefully that won't happen. Also with us is our favorite aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
I'm the only aviation historian. Hi, guys. Yes, I'm sorry. I've been away. Life sometimes gets in the way of podcasting, so I'm here tonight, at least in spirit, so we're looking forward to a really good conversation.
All right, and speaking of getting in the way, here's our associate producer, Brian Coleman. He's back with us.
Getting in the way? What was I in the way of?
I don't know.
Sheesh.
It just seemed like a good segue.
No, yeah, it seems like it's been years since I've done this show. I thought this was going to be a easy year for me, and it's turning out to be crazy, and already this year I have 35,000 miles booked.
My goodness. All right.
Not flown yet, but booked. And that's only through the end of February.
Ouch.
It's crazy. Yeah.
All right. Well, hopefully you'll be able to make as many episodes as possible. And finally, we have with us Rob Mark. He's the senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody in from Chicago, where we have no ice storm at all.
You're lucky. Usually you have the bad weather, but I think it's David and I this time.
Well, you're all kind of out there. Steve's out that way, too, our guest, didn't he?
That's right. Well, let's introduce our guest this episode. It's Stephen Pope. He's the editor-in-chief of Flying Magazine. Now, he's an award-winning aviation journalist and commercial pilot with multi-engine, instrument, and seaplane ratings. Steve has been writing for aviation magazines for more than 20 years on topics ranging from advanced cockpit technology to tailwheel flying technique, and he's won 7 Aerospace Journalist of the Year awards. Steve, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks, guys. Thanks a lot. Glad to be here. As they say, long-time listener, first-time caller.
We should have a little bell or something when somebody does that.
Just, a ring bell.
Anyway, huh? Yeah, anyway. All right.
Steve, you have that, well, I don't know, what I would call, I guess, that classic aviation background. You learned to fly at age 15. You worked at Teterboro Airport, soloed at 16, earned your private pilot's license at 17, getting your instrument rating a year later. You went to university, you got a degree in, or majoring in journalism, started your career as an editorial intern with AOPA Pilot Magazine, and I understand you went on to Aviation International News and Business Jet Traveler Magazine, then joined the staff of Flying in 2010. So what a great background. Would you have done any of that differently, Steve, if you'd had the opportunity?
No, it actually worked out better than I could have hoped. So I wouldn't do anything different. Ever since I was a kid, I knew I wanted to be involved in aviation, either as a professional pilot or in some way. And it was really the aviation magazines was the way that I was able to touch aviation as a kid growing up and just being an airplane geek and wanting to be a pilot. And I thought, you know, working for an aviation magazine just seems like it would be the coolest job in the world. And so that's why I decided to go to college to go to school for journalism and went from there. And, you know, now to be editor-in-chief of Flying Magazine, it fulfills every dream that I had when I was a 9-year-old kid first starting to think about this career path. So it's really pretty amazing to me.
Do you still have time for flying, or do your responsibilities at the magazine kind of consume you?
Well, I'm pretty busy, but no, it's a 2012 Cirrus SR-22 that I fly out of Morristown Airport, not far from where I live in northern New Jersey. So I still get to fly, and then I get to fly when I do pilot reports. So I like to fly as much as I can. Love it.
That's perfect. All right, well, we've got a kind of a full agenda, so why don't we jump right in with the aviation news from the past week? Is everyone ready?
Yep. Ready.
Ready. Ready from the West.
Our first story comes from CNN. This is United Airlines resumes flights after temporary ground order. And this was written, or co-written, I should say, by our friend John Ostrower. Well, a computer problem, I think, with ACARS temporarily grounded all domestic United mainline flights. ACARS, of course, is the system used to communicate information between the airplane and United operations. This is sort of the continuing saga of, I think, airlines encountering computer problems that really shut the place down. Max T., is this surprising to you at all?
Well, having just lived that nightmare yesterday on a United aircraft, no. it was really kind of interesting. I spent the weekend in Houston down there for a wedding. We hopped on our United flight back to San Francisco. Was supposed to leave about 6:20 or so, sometime soon after 6, just before we were getting ready to go. They started noticing a problem, which was flight plans were not coming through on the ACARS. Apparently, it was limited to just United. We were told that it was a third-party company that provided the data, so not necessarily ACARS, but some other company that does the flight plans for United. So I'm not really sure which it was. That's what the pilot was telling us. But yeah, we sat there for 2.5 hours until they finally got things fixed. The really ironic thing is there were aircraft that had their data, had made it to the runway. The FAA then put in a nationwide ground stop for United. Those planes were stuck there as well, even though they had everything they needed to go.
And you said this was like 2.5 hours?
Yeah, 2.5 hours is about the total time that we were delayed.
You know, it's interesting. I wonder if you guys had sat there for 3 hours, I wonder if they would have tried to enforce that DOT rule about
the penalty
on the ramp. That would have really turned it ugly.
Yeah. And while we were waiting, I was up front chatting with the pilots, and they brought that up. At the point I was up there, they said that guys at the runway had been there for 90 minutes and already were starting to figure out how they would come back into plane, and they'd already determined that every gate in Houston was full of aircraft that couldn't depart. So it was no place for them to go. So these pilots were saying, well, maybe they could find a stairs shark somewhere, which I know our friend Jennifer out in Ohio would be thrilled, since I think that's her favorite vehicle.
Yes.
Hey, Max, dear Rob, with something like that, why not just get some tugs and take the planes at the gate and put them in, parking lot or ramp someplace and allow the other planes to pull up to a gate and deplane?
Well, I guess it's possible. I think the airlines probably would have to close the door, and then they'd start paying the pilot at that point. So they probably wouldn't want to do that.
I'll bet you they hadn't even thought that far ahead, to tell you the truth.
Steve, don't airlines have backup systems for the eventuality that some system will fail, like ACARS, or the communications link will go down or something? Is there a backup,
Well, yeah, you would hope that there would be a backup, but in a case like that, if it's a third party provider that's getting them their primary data, they're kind of stuck in the water at that point, and it kind of makes you wonder, will that third party vendor continue to be United's ACARS flight plan vendor? But it's if the system goes down, there can be points where if something happens even though they have robust backup systems built in, that they cannot react to certain things. And I'm sure it's something that United will be taking a close look at.
Yeah, if the penalties had kicked in, then any savings they had from outsourcing would have been totally wiped out by those penalties. You know, when the data finally started to flow, something really bizarre happened. Airplanes in Houston were getting the wrong information, so messages were going to the wrong aircraft. Fortunately, the pilots were able to identify that, so they had to sit there and wait until it got further sorted out, and the sorted out, and the correct data came to each aircraft.
Interesting. All right, let's move on to story number two. This is from, the ABC affiliate in Houston. Cool or creepy? Houston Airport's now tracking phone signals to provide checkpoint data. Well, that sounds interesting. Tracking checkpoint wait times in real time? To me, that seems like that would be really, really useful to the airport, be useful for passengers, and hopefully also the airport security would be interested in that kind of information. So Houston airports are now employing a technology at all of their checkpoints that's similar to what some other airports are doing, and they're using Bluetooth signals from travelers' phones. In a news release, the Houston airport spokesperson, Bill Begley, said that the tracking is anonymous and uses a variety of filters to ensure both anonymity and accuracy, and then uses that data to provide an average time for travelers passing through the checkpoints. It's kind of a clever use of people who happen to have Bluetooth turned on in their phones. But it is kind of slightly creepy to me anyway. I don't know. What do you guys think?
It is, but it's not. If you look at the way Google Maps works, for example, with the traffic reporting, I always thought it was done by sensors in the lanes, but it's not. It's they're looking at everyone's cell phone and determining if the phones are moving on the roads. And that's what determines if there's a red, yellow, or green line on the freeway. I'm more surprised that the airport's using Bluetooth instead of, Wi-Fi or the cell signal itself. So I don't know. I don't so much have a problem with this.
Wi-Fi would probably localize it a lot more because the distance you can go with with Bluetooth is very, very short.
Yeah.
So that would probably really narrow down, give you much better resolution as positioning of people.
Yeah, you just need a lot more.
Do you walk around with the Bluetooth turned on your phone?
No.
Yeah, that's my point, is I don't think there would be many people that they'd pick up the signal on as opposed to the cellular signal or the Wi-Fi signal, because I think a lot more people would have that turned on. But maybe it doesn't take that many people. Hey, and I didn't submit the previous United story, by the way, so just want everyone to know.
You're off the hook.
I've had a good experience so far this year on United.
And my flight outbound, my first flight in the 787, so that was a great way to start the trip to Houston anyway, even if the United flight back was delayed.
Did United keep you pretty informed of the situation and what was happening?
They couldn't have been better. I would say every 15 to 20 minutes, the captain was on the plane giving us an update. So, yeah, they were awesome.
Okay. All right. Well, another, kind of a milestone, I guess. This is from AvWeb. Search ends for Malaysian Flight 370. Now, in a MH370 joint communique, the Australian government announced that the search has been suspended. They covered 120,000 square kilometers underwater. That was the search area. It cost about $150 million. And the statement reads, quote, "The decision to suspend the underwater search has not been taken lightly, nor without sadness. We remain hopeful that new information will come to light and that at some point in the future, the aircraft will be located." Rob, does this mean, in effect, that it's not going to be located unless somehow accidentally somebody finds it or some clues or something?
Sounds like it to me. I mean, for the longest time, we kind of got all involved in, did they find it yet? Did they find it yet? But the information they were using from the Inmarsat satellites back a couple of years ago was very sketchy to begin with. It's not as if they, they had triangulated anything. So I think after a number of years, when you start to extrapolate from kind of sketchy data, even when I did some TV segments and they'd say, well, why didn't they find it? And I said, because they're probably looking in the wrong place, except that no one knows where the right place is, I don't think. And so will they ever find it? Boy, I sure don't see how it's going to happen unless, again, somebody just happens to stumble on it. But that water's really deep there.
And there's an awful lot of it. And is it even in the water? Maybe it landed on, you know, an island. No, I mean, an unpopulated island. I mean, it could have. It.
When you say you say landed, you mean crashed, right?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay.
I just want to be sure there was no conspiracy theory going on.
None at all. But anyone that's been out on a boat in a body of water, the Pacific Ocean or Indian Ocean is huge. And to find something, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. So I really think that some marine biologist is going to find it someday.
You wonder how big that needle is. You know, I suspect they've been looking for a large object. Since piece has been found, clearly the thing fragmented when it hit the water. I just wonder how big the biggest piece is, and maybe that's part of the problem.
Yeah, maybe it's spread out. Well, and
look back at the loss of the Air France airplane back years ago. I mean, the only reason they were able to pin it down was because they found some huge pieces of wreckage floating on the water. And they kind of worked from there, but they had nothing, absolutely nothing to go on other than this data that the Inmarsat people, pulled off the satellite. And that was it.
And the debris that washed up. So they can be they can be reasonably sure that they're looking and at least, you know, they're in the right ocean, but that doesn't help.
You're right. That's probably about it.
Well, there's a follow-on story here that kind of relates to this, actually more than kind of. This was actually written by Rob in Flying Magazine, Ariane Launch.
Do you guys read Flying?
Yes.
And I get it, too. It's right here on my desk.
Yeah.
I'm just checking. I didn't give him any warning on that, Steve, so.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, in fact, Max T came up with this article. Ariane launch begins new era for satellite-based aircraft surveillance. And we mentioned the successful SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket launch that put, the first 10 Iridium Next satellites into low Earth orbit?
I saw a great video. It was shot from a GA aircraft at 8,500 feet near Vandenberg when that thing took off. It was so much fun to see that launch from the air. But let's have Rob talk about it because I'm sure he knows more. He wrote the story.
Well, thanks. I wish I could have seen that launch from Vandenberg. It sounds like it would have been exciting. But, yeah. Of course, we've had Matt Detsch on the show before, and I can remember the last time we were talking about not too long in the distant future they're going to start firing off those Falcons and putting the satellites into orbit. But long before that, after all the grief about the loss of MH370, there was a lot of talk about the fact that we should be able to tell where airplanes are around the world, and lots of plans. ICAO was involved in trying to set some possible standards for how aircraft can be tracked. But the big problem was that really none of the airlines decided to do anything with that because it would have cost them to buy the service from the Inmarsat people. And, of course, the wonderful part about what the Ariane folks are doing is that they're launching all these new satellites, and they said, hey, what if we put an ADS-B receiver in each one of them, and long as they're up there, they can listen for ADS-B signals, and they're going to be worldwide. And that is going to be the new tracking system that – as I understand it, at least, will be sort of rolled into the cost of air traffic control services for those organizations around the globe that are going to use them. And I think when I talked to Matt the last week, I think he said they should be up and rolling by the middle of, I think by summer of 2018, if I'm not mistaken, I think that may be what I wrote down.
Yes, yeah, second quarter of 2018. So, yeah, that put it right in the middle of 2018.
Man, we'll know where everybody is. I mean, it's not that hard, but, you know, again, it's spending money, and some people just, you know, that's another issue. So
This is a great new revenue opportunity, I think, for the airlines. You know, it can be $50 if you want to check a bag, and another $75 if you want to get found.
Does this just apply to commercial aviation? This isn't something for general or business aviation, or is it?
If you have ADS-B out, it's going to know where you are.
Oh, everybody, huh?
So then, you know, when Steve decides to fly that G6 westbound across or eastbound across the Atlantic because he wants to go to E-Base, you know, they'll know where he is, except not this year, Steve.
I can't hide.
That's right.
Yeah, Max, if people want to look at the Vandenberg launch schedule, they could just Google Vandenberg launch schedule, and there's a bunch of sites that show all the launch dates. And I'm fortunate when I'm looking in the right direction and no launch is going on, I could actually see it from my backyard, which is kind of fun.
Wow. Did you see this one?
No, I didn't. Didn't know what was going on. The first time I saw it, though, I didn't know exactly where Vandenberg was and what they were doing. And watching a nighttime launch with a big glow is kind of scary. I kind of thought it was the beginning of the end.
Yeah, I saw one accidentally once. I was on a cruise ship down near Catalina somewhere and looked up and thought, what the heck is that? And yeah. To my credit, I figured it out. But, you know, it did leave me kind of guessing there for a little bit of time.
All right, we have some news on the Mitsubishi MRJ, the regional jet.
And it's not good.
It is not good. There is a delay. In fact, the delay is 2 years. Now, in its press release that actually I think they released today, this morning, on the 23rd of January, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries announced, quote, that MHI and Mitsubishi Aircraft Corporation will adjust the first delivery of the Mitsubishi regional jet, the MRJ, from mid-2018 to mid-2020. The change is due to revisions of certain systems and electrical configurations on the aircraft to meet the latest requirements for certification. We'll have some links to some of the documents, and there's an interesting PDF that Mitsubishi created called Advancing the MRJ Project. We'll put all those in the show notes. But, you know, in there, I don't see anything with more detail about just exactly what this issue with certain systems and electrical configurations are.
Yeah, are they relaying out the cockpit there? Or, I mean, what are they doing? Because it seems like the instruments should be where they are and they should work. And I just don't get the certification. I'm kind of sad that it is going to be delayed because I was really looking forward to flying it. When Mike and I were over in Farnborough, they had a mock-up there. And it's really nice on the inside.
Right. And, of course, we have the test aircraft flying in the United States. You know, some of this documentation that they've provided that MHI has is kind of interesting to me. One is the structural change. Now, MHI recently established what they call the MRJ Business Promotion Committee, chaired by, get this, the president and CEO of MHI. And the idea is that he's going to personally oversee the continued development and long-term business performance of the MRJ. Now, they've got two teams that they've created, the MRJ development team, and that's the team, it looks like they're doing the you know, the test flights and all. And then, in addition to that, the Future Advanced Technology Development team. But when you look at that PDF document that that I mentioned earlier, they talk about, well, how they're going to address the problem, but it's things like better communication, more effective use of IT systems. If you're familiar at all with sort of the Japanese approach to problem solving, continuous improvement, those kinds of things, this looks a lot, at least to me, like they've spent a lot of time determining just what is the reason that they require this 2-year delay. And they've created this structure personally overseen by the CEO to try to address those process problems or process issues. So it's very interesting, but 2 years is that's a long delay.
That's a serious delay. I mean, can you imagine to have the company's CEO saying, I'm going to help you guys fix this problem? How many people do you think probably lost their jobs at Mitsubishi Heavy Industries before the CEO came on board. But boy, a two-year delay. That's not a little software problem like what we were seeing when the 787 design was kind of coughing here and there. I mean, the 2 years is a serious problem.
Well, Rob, it's actually five from the original launch date, which is really unfortunate. Building a plane's a complex thing, and these guys are figuring it out.
Exactly. That's why there's so few people that that do this around the world. It is highly complex.
Oh, yeah. But when you use that structural word, I kind of cringed, and I thought, ooh, I can't imagine what that's going to be.
Yeah. Now, of course, the launch customer for the MRJ is ANA, All Nippon Airways. So I'm sure there have been lots of conversations with that airline about this push out in deliveries, as well as with all their other customers who hold orders with them. So, I mean, we all want to see them succeed, but it sounds like they've got their work cut out for them.
Well, and I think ANA is probably going to be willing to wait. Think of the national pride that's involved. You know, you've got a Japanese airline, and they're very interested in having the first Japanese-built airliner, you know, first new design in 50 years. So it's a big deal.
Yeah, and they want it to be perfect first time.
Yeah.
All right, a couple other stories. Maybe quickly, The Aviationist. All we know about the U.S. B-2 bomber's 30-hour round-trip mission to pound Daesh in Libya. Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting when that hit the news. The interesting part of it from the aviation standpoint is, David, what, these B-2 bombers went on quite a lengthy mission.
Well, I don't know. 30 hours in a cockpit is a long time.
I think so.
I think I'm pretty sure that Rob and Trescott would have been killing each other by about hour 12.
not true. We have a bromance going here.
Hour five.
So obviously this would have involved a number of in-flight refuelings. Well, I say obviously. I don't know how many in-flight refuelings would be required.
15 tankers supported the two B-2s.
Wow.
They took off from Whiteman Air Force Base in the middle of the United States and flew the pond, as they like to call it. On the East Coast, they made their first refuelings with KC-10s out of McGuire. Then they flew over the pond, met up with KC-135 from Great Britain, did their mission, which surprisingly involved about an hour's worth of loitering.
Huh.
They dropped the bombs, and then they hung around just to make sure everything got taken care of, and then flew back, met the tankers again over the Straits of Gibraltar, and then flew home. 15 tankers for two B-2s. This is long-range power projection. I don't know of anybody else in the world that can deploy two bombers from the center of their country to another part of the world and then return them back 30 hours later. I'm desperate to find out what the crew management system is like on a 30-hour mission, considering a B-2 only holds two people. Three with a jump seat, but these were flown with a pilot and a co-pilot, and you got to sleep with a 30-hour mission and eat and go to the bathroom, and all of that's in a B-2, but it is a very, very long mission for killing several hundred or at least 100 ISIS militants in Libya at the request of the Libyan government.
Have the B-2s been used for a mission like this before?
Absolutely. They've been used. They have used them in Afghanistan and flown. Those missions, though, usually involve a stop at in the Indian Ocean at
Diego Garcia.
Diego Garcia. Thank you, Max Trescott.
Happy to help.
But 15 tankers supported them, so there was probably about six refueling.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm just wondering with this, wouldn't it have been a whole lot more cost-effective and possibly more efficient to launch some missiles from a submarine instead of fly an aircraft so far? Or do you think this was more of a technology demonstration?
Boy, aren't those sub-cruise missiles about $1.2 million a pop or something? David, you probably know.
This is a far more effective... The other part about cruise missiles is you don't have the ability to hang around to see if you got everything. Keep in mind that the B-2s actually did a couple of orbits and were supported by a UAV doing battle damage assessment, a Global Hawk.
Yeah, good point.
I was listening to Aviation Week's Check 6 podcast today. They said that there was an F-22 overhead flying a high cover. They also said that the operating cost per hour is about $128,000, I think, for the B-2, and said that that's, you know, very high compared to other aircraft, but that their weapons load is huge compared to other aircraft for these highly targeted type missiles. I think they said each one could carry 80 versus, what, maybe 24, was it, in the B-52? David, you probably know the numbers.
They're using something called a small diameter bomblet now, which they can put a lot of them into a truck, and you're not taking out major cities. You're taking out a large area of tents. So you want to be at least cost effective. Shoving a cruise missile down a camp of tents in some abandoned buildings is probably not a good use of a cruise missile. Not to mention, we have a limited amount of cruise missiles until we get them back into production. So they're kind of, you want to pick your weapons carefully when you're running out of long range cruise missiles. That you want to use them for high priority targets or hardened targets. This is actually was taking out tents and people, so, and pickup trucks.
Boy, I got to ask. David, tell us why the cruise missile's out of production right now. What's the holdup on that? Is it budget or is there a technical issue?
MONEY.
Yep.
We haven't produced them since the late 90s.
Really? Huh.
Wow.
No idea. Let me ask you this, David, and this just occurred to me, but obviously the B-2 is a manned bomber. Could an unmanned a bomber, either a B-2 or something that has the same capability, would that have been able to perform, in your opinion, the same mission?
To be honest, I think a mission like this, you definitely want humans in the cockpit. This isn't precision targeting from a Reaper or a Predator where you're working remotely. The B-2's operated with four people. It's really not that big of a deal, other than, and the B-2s or pilots are different. To become part of the 509th as a pilot, and there aren't a lot of B-2 pilots, you are a different type of personality. You have to be able to work with somebody for 30 hours in a confined cockpit. And crew management on a B-2 is very, very different than, say, a jet fighter with a single person in it, or an airliner. I don't know of many airliners that are flying 30 hours. Hmm. So they're designed. These are people who have a mental toughness to be able to handle the pressure of flying a mission to the other side of the world and back and working with one other person. In fact, this is one of those things they've determined that a lot of times women are better at flying B-2s than men. Hmm. They have more patience when it comes to these long-term missions. One of the most interesting missions a B-2 does is flies the Rose Bowl on January 1st.
Right.
They fly the Rose Parade. Well, what most people don't realize is they fly the Rose Parade, and then they also fly the Rose Bowl as the flyover for that. And that was done by the same aircraft. It goes out. They fly a long-term mission in time for the parade. They get to a certain point, turn around, and fly back to do the flyover for the Rose Bowl to fly back to Whiteman in the center of the country. Hmm. So the other interesting thing was the last time I've seen a B-2 fly at an air show, they had taken off from Whiteman, had hit Andrews Air Force Base for the flyover there, did three passes there, then proceeded to fly down to Atlanta for another flyover at an air show, then flew over to Louisiana, and then flew back to Whitman. They hit three air shows in one day by one aircraft, and it was unmanned. It was flown by two women.
Wow. Fantastic.
And this is Steve. In 1949, a relative of mine flew a Boeing B-50 Super Fortress around the world. It was the first circumnavigation of the globe that had ever been done. It was refueled four times by B-29s that were strategically placed to carry out this mission. And that flight took 94 hours and 1 minute.
That's a long flight.
There was a lot more people in that B-50 than there were in these two B-2s.
Oh, yeah. The name of that plane is Lucky Lady 2, and it's actually that the airplane is at Planes of Fame Museum in Chino, California.
Oh, and this was a relative.
Yeah. His name is Captain James Gallagher. Wow. He was the commander of the airplane.
Cool.
And then Lucky Lady 4 was a B-52 that did the same thing later for SAC.
Yeah. When Lucky Lady 2 did it, it was testing, and it was also a publicity tour. It was the military wanted to prove the concept of aerial refueling, and of course Pratt and Whitney wanted to prove prove what their engines could do.
Hmm, sure. All right. Just quickly, Max T, tell us about tilt rotors.
Oh, so one of the largest wind tunnels in the world is at NASA Ames, which is located at Moffett Field, right next to me here in Mountain View, California. They have just announced, and this was an article that came through aeronews.net, that's aero-news.net, that they are putting in a new test rig inside that wind tunnel, which will allow the testing of large tilt rotors. And I guess that's going to become functional, or they're going to start the first functional trials of that next month. So it's kind of interesting that the infrastructure is being transitioned to handle these new technologies.
Max, have you ever been there when they fired up the wind tunnel?
You know, I don't know that I've actually been there on the ground. I think I have because, yeah, it's pretty noisy.
Yeah.
And there's also a warning for local aircraft to not overfly it because the wind is directed upward, and it's 2.5. Well, it's closer to 3.5 miles from where I land at Palo Alto.
Yeah, previous job of mine, I had the privilege of touring the facility and being in the wind tunnel, they have many wind tunnels there, but the large one, it's impressive.
Steve, just between you and me, you know, I always thought tilt rotors seemed, I don't know, so ungainly, such a strange way to configure an aircraft. What do you think about tilt rotors?
Well, the V-22 holds the distinction of being, I believe, the first military aircraft that ever ended up in a museum before it ended up in operational service.
that museum is right around the corner from us.
Yeah, it took so long to get the tilt rotor into service, and it's understandable because it's such a complicated system. It's just so incredibly complicated, and you wonder if we were to go back in time to when the V-22 was first being contemplated, and the designers of that aircraft could look into the future and see all the problems that they would face, all the trouble with that airplane. Would they go forward and actually do it? And the answer might be no.
Hmm. All right, one last item. Again, Max T, there's some news on D.B. Cooper?
Well, who knows? It's a theory, but it's a fun one. The story comes from avweb.com, and there's apparently a team of amateur investigators up in the, I believe, in the Seattle area, which were allowed access to the FBI's files, and that was part of a television show called Expedition Unknown, and they were able to fund analysis of a clip-on necktie that was found in the airplane that they believe belonged to the hijacker, and they did particle analysis, and in that analysis, they looked at what kinds of chemicals, residues, and substances were in the tie, and they found, among other things, cigarette smoke. So they knew that the D.B. Cooper had smoked cigarettes on the aircraft. They found, get this, some pure titanium and 5,000 series aluminum, which all have anti-corrosive properties and are the kind of things most likely in the Northwest found in the fabrication shops of Boeing. So this theory is that maybe this guy was a Boeing employee.
Can I just suggest that maybe for our younger listeners, they're wondering, who the heck is D.B. Cooper?
Good point. Tell us.
Me? It wasn't me.
Oh, that's right. You're too young to remember. That's right.
Right. I don't even remember what it was he supposedly hijacked. I just remember.
It was a 720. It was a 727 with the rear stair door.
Right.
That's right.
Right. So he got his ransom money, right, and disappeared out the tail.
That's right. Supposedly parachuted off the airplane, was never seen or heard from again.
He requested a number of military-style parachutes, right, and he only used one of them. He chain-smoked cigarettes on the flight, and then when he jumped out, he was never seen or heard from again. But years later, on a sandbar, there was a family that was camping, and they found some of the money, and it was a little bit singed on the edges, maybe burned, or maybe it was just deteriorated from nature. But they found this money and they turned it into the FBI, and it turned out that, sure enough, this was some of the money. So then it started the question of how did the money get there, and there had been some dredging on that island, and that question really has never been answered either. How did the money get to that island, which really wasn't, if I'm recalling correctly, really wasn't over where they think where he jumped out. Did it wash down river somehow? And it's a really fascinating story. But I'm surprised. Did the FBI not analysis on the tie ever before?
You know, it doesn't say that in the story, and I'm just wondering if perhaps there were some new analysis capabilities that didn't exist back in 1971 when this hijacking occurred.
Yeah, because I seem to recall that they said that, like, the titanium and the tie, and I'm not sure if it was from this story or a different one, there's only a few places in the world where that even could come from. So you've narrowed it down. So if they've picked Boeing as being one of those potential places, and this, of course, was up in the Pacific Northwest, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it does make you kind of wonder, if you could go back in time and figure out, hey, who didn't show up for work there after the hijacking? Yeah.
Hey, Max West, do you remember how much money he supposedly absconded with?
Yeah, $200,000, which was real money back then.
Yeah, now it's not quite as much.
Yeah, I'm kind of joking, but I know inflation is up by a factor of at least 3x, maybe closer to 4 since 1971. Yeah, and they recovered $5,800. So the vast majority of the money was never found, and just a lot of theories as to when he jumped out of the back of the airplane. Did he survive? And where exactly did it land? And is he still around?
They had every serial number of every bill that was part of that, and not $1 that they know of was ever spent. It's never turned up anywhere.
And I just read in a separate story, I don't know, somewhere in the past month or two, that he's always been referred to as D.B. Cooper. That name was mistakenly given by some newspaper reporting it, but apparently he was officially known as Dan Cooper.
Yeah, and Dan Cooper was a comic book figure or something like that up in Canada. And so that led to some theories about he must have, because he named himself Dan Cooper. And so he must have been familiar with this comic book, so he was probably a Canadian, which I think is another interesting theory.
Well, the mystery continues.
And it's a fun one.
All right, again, we're speaking with Steve Pope, editor-in-chief at Flying Magazine. As Rob has mentioned, every episode, you can find that at flyingmag.com. They're also on Twitter as Flying Magazine, same on Facebook. Steve, just to set the stage a little bit for some of the listeners who may not be familiar with Flying Magazine, tell us a little bit about sort of the scope of the coverage and the audience that it's trying to attract.
Okay. Yeah, Flying is written really primarily for pilots, and it's to drill down a little deeper, it's really for general aviation pilots, and we cover the market, everything from light sport aircraft all the way up through general aviation and into business aviation. We cover a little bit of military, a little bit of airline, even a little bit of space, but really our target area of coverage is really in general aviation, owner flown, people who might own their own Cirrus or might own their own Meridian or TBM turboprop and up into jets. We've got about 200,000 subscribers. We've got about 315,000 followers on Facebook. And the magazine was founded 90 years ago. So we're in that market. We're the oldest aviation magazine covering general aviation.
You mentioned the LSA market, and that's always been kind of interesting to me. When the light sport aircraft concept was, you know, first created, I guess you'd say, there was a lot of excitement and belief and hope that this is something that would bring a lot of new people into flying. Has it worked out that way?
No, not quite. And there's several reasons for that. You know, one of the really interesting aspects to the light sport market, though, is that there are actually over 50 manufacturers of light sport aircraft around the world. And that's pretty incredible when you think about it, because of manufacturers of, say, piston general aviation Part 23 certified airplanes. You know, it's a fraction of that. But, you know, that being said, of the 50 manufacturers of LSAs, none of them are building very many airplanes, and a handful of them are probably, you know, making very much money. There are some successful LSA manufacturers, but the market, it never really panned out the way that everyone thought. Cessna got involved with it with the Skycatcher, and you know, that airplane failed in the marketplace. Piper got involved in it with the Sport Cruiser, which was a Czech design that they had partnered on. That didn't last very long. Cirrus looked at the market for a little while, but realized that that it wouldn't work out for them. So it's kind of a good news, bad news story. It has really opened up, you know, for the sport pilots who are out there who are flying light sport aircraft and they like their light sport aircraft. It's great for them, but the market really never became what the FAA and the industry envisioned when they created the rule, these rules over a decade ago. Now, if you look at the Part 23 rewrite that I'm sure you guys have discussed many times. That's kind of the FAA, I think, seeing where they, in a way, where they went wrong with light sport. They had this arbitrary weight restriction to a very light airplane that really didn't do what they thought it would do, because a lot of pilots looked at that and said, I don't want a light airplane that I can't fly IFR, that I can't carry more than one passenger with me. I want a real airplane. And so the Part 23 rewrite, that is going to usher in an era of airplanes that are larger, can carry more passengers, can fly IFR day or night. And that could really be something significant. And also, they've just passed third class medical reform and the basic med. So you won't need a third class medical, which was always... that was always the thing for sport pilots. Hey, I don't need a medical. I'm going to go do that. Well, now you'll be able to just go and fly a certified airplane. And what I could see, though, as a benefit for these light sport aircraft manufacturers, and I'm sure the ones that are doing better financially are looking at this and saying, you know what? We make LSAs now, but this Part 23 rate is coming. In a few years, we're going to start making larger airplanes. And that will be very interesting, because that market will be larger than the LSA market. You know, how big, it's hard to say. It's going to be limited by the economy. It's going to be limited by the number of pilots that can afford to do it. But I think we're on the cusp of seeing some really interesting changes here in the next 5 or 10 years. I think it's going to be very, very interesting and very exciting.
So do you think that some of the existing LSA makers will start to develop these larger aircraft as opposed to the established airframe makers kind of moving down to that new larger LSA?
Yeah, I think you will. I think you'll see some, and especially some of the companies over in Europe. You know, you have Pipistrel over there. You have some companies that have been doing pretty well making light sport aircraft, and I think they're going to look at the Part 23 rewrite. You have Flight Design. They've actually already announced that they are doing it. Pipistrel, which makes light sport aircraft, they have been designing the Pantera, which is a four-place. It's a pretty sexy airplane, but they've slowed development of that. And, you know, if you had to guess, you might think, well, they probably slowed development of it because they're waiting for this for the Part 23 rewrite to come along so that they can take advantage of whatever the rules allow them to do. The big advantage of the Part 23 rewrite will be that development costs will be much lower, because you'll be able to it won't be so restrictive. Rather than the FAA telling you, you must design your master switch has to look like this, you'll be able to design whatever you want. And as long as it does its job and does it safely, if it costs half as much, the FAA will say, that's fine. We sign off on it, which is a change. I mean, these are rules that were written 50 years ago and they've just been set in stone. And finally, the FAA is realizing that the pace of technological innovation won't allow for that any longer, and that we have to let aircraft manufacturers design airplanes the way that makes sense, rather than what, you know, some rules that were written decades ago tell us.
And now I understand that Flying Magazine's a media sponsor for the upcoming U.S. Sport Aviation Expo. That's in Sebring, Florida, is that? What are you kind of expecting from that event?
Yeah, this is our first year as a media sponsor of that event. So I'm really going to be down there looking at the light sport aircraft that are available. I've flown a number of them, but I'm certainly not familiar with all of them. I would say that, you know, some light sport aircraft are really good airplanes. Some of them, not so much. The handling characteristics leave something to be desired. So I'll be down there investigating the airplanes. I'm also giving a couple talks. I'm giving a talk on making better takeoffs and landings, which I think it's even more important for a sport pilot in a light airplane to you know, really be spot on with their landing and takeoff techniques. And I'm also giving a talk on flying in the sharing economy, which I think there's a lot of opportunity within aviation broadly for sharing economy type concepts. And I think the light sport aircraft market can absolutely take advantage of those.
Rob, have you done much light sport flying?
Well, not that much until recently. Of course, when I was over in Germany a couple of months ago, I was out flying the Rimos GXIS airplane, which is their new entry into the light sport aircraft market headed for the U.S. But I think Steve's point is really a good one about how the Part 23 rewrite is going to affect larger aircraft and how much they can be created for. Because when you look at the price of a Rimos, I think halfway is decently equipped. It's in the high 180s. But then what happens if a company is able to produce a new four-place airplane with, you know, under the Part 23 that comes in at, I don't know, 2.25 or something, you know? Or, I mean, it's really going to make it hard to sell a two-seater airplane if you can have a four-seater for what seems like not a whole lot less. But, of course, all of these prices are never going to be where people initially thought they were years ago with LSAs. I mean, people thought they were going to get $50,000 brand-new airplanes, and, of course, that never materialized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it'll make it difficult also for the established general aviation manufacturers. You know, think of a price of a Cessna Skyhawk. You know, it's an airplane that's been around that basic design since 1955. It's still in production, and the price of one equipped the way you'd want it is around $400,000. So if 5 years from now, Rimos, you know, say they get into the market and they've got an airplane that performs as well as a Skyhawk does, but the purchase price is $225,000, that puts a lot of pressure on Cessna and on Piper and on the legacy manufacturers, and it will really force them to get rid of the Skyhawk, I suppose, and come out with something new, which ultimately is probably a good thing.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, as Steve said, in the next decade or so.
Steve, tell us a little bit more about Basic Med. We talked about that a little bit last episode, I think it was, and maybe the effect of those rules on the sport pilot market.
Yeah, I've been surprised to read on some of the online forums that reading a lot of pilots are positive about it, of course, but then there's been a whole group of pilots who are very negative, saying it doesn't go far enough, that it's they're just going to go and continue to get a third class medical. And I kind of disagree that it didn't go far enough. I think it's a huge change. I mean, you'll be able to go and continue flying without having to visit an FAA aviation medical examiner, who during that exam, if he sees something he doesn't like, he gives you the red stamp, you can't fly. You've got to jump through all sorts of hoops. Now, instead, you'll take an online aeromedical factors training course once every 2 years. It will be free through the AOPA Air Safety Foundation. And then you'll visit your own doctor once every 4 years, and you'll bring a form, and he'll go through some protocols and look you over, and he'll sign that off. But you never have to report the findings to the FAA. You just take that piece of paper, slide it into your logbook, and that's it. So basically, it's self-reporting for general aviation pilots to be able to continue flying, that's what they do right now under the rules for third class medical. If you know that you're medically unfit to fly, then you don't fly. But this gets rid of the requirement for you to go see an aviation medical examiner. Some of the younger pilots, though, who if you're under 40, you only have to go, you know, once every 5 years. And so they're saying, oh, this is harder. Now I have to take a course every 2 years. I have to go see my regular doctor every 4 years. I'll just do it the old way and continue. And I'm young and I'm healthy. You know, and for those guys, it's probably okay. But guess what? Once they get older and they get above 40, now they've got to go to an AME every 2 years. And so that makes it attractive. And it also allow a lot of people who haven't flown in a while, because they know that they're going to have to jump through all these hoops with the FAA. Once these new rules pass and they're going to take effect on May 1st, they'll be able to go the same route. If you've held a valid medical certificate anytime in the last 10 years, you will be able to take advantage of basic med and, you know, go take the online course. You take the test as many times as it takes you to pass. You go see your personal physician, and there you go. And people are saying, well, is a personal physician who knows nothing about aviation, they're not going to sign some form. That will open them up to liability and litigation if the guy goes and crashes. And that's a question I don't know the answer to. So we'll see. I mean, I think once general practitioners understand what this is, and it is a fairly basic test, it's no really different than what you'd have for an employee screening of a health assessment, I think they'll be fine. And I think if it's an issue for you that you go to a doctor and he won't sign the form, my advice to you would be then doctor shop. Go to the next doctor. If you get to five doctors and none of them will sign a form saying you're fit to fly, then guess what? Maybe you're not fit to fly.
Now, the process of developing the new rules involved, I think, several different parties with different perspectives. How did that come together into the final rules? What interests were there out there that were looking to make their positions known?
Well, AOPA and EAA had been Aircraft Owners and Pilot Association, and the Experimental Aircraft Association had been trying to promulgate these rules and get them moving within the FAA for a very long time. Sport pilot, those rules were created over 10 years ago. We've got lots of data showing that sport pilots who are flying without medical certificates are no less safe than any other pilot. So we've got the data. We present it to the FAA and say, let's do this for the rest of general aviation for private pilots. The problem was the FAA didn't really seem too keen on doing it. But as they were debating it, the Airline Pilots Association came out with a statement saying that we do not want to share the skies with medically unfit pilots.
I remember that, yes.
Yeah. And at this time, the Pilots Bill of Rights 2 had been created in Congress that included this third class medical reform, which became basic med. And it was moving through Congress pretty well, and it seemed like it was getting a lot of traction. It seemed like it had the votes to pass. And it was going to pass. It was going to be really pretty great for general aviation. Well, then ALPA came out with that infamous statement, and it just put the brakes on things. Now you had folks in Congress who were just they were very skittish about putting their name on anything where the Airline Pilots Association had told them, we don't want to share the skies with you know, these aging pilots who shouldn't be up there in the first place.
And that reaction is somewhat understandable.
Yeah, it is somewhat understandable. But like I said, the data shows that sport pilots are no less safe in the air than pilots who go get their FAA medical. Let's be honest. When you go to your aviation medical examiner for a third class medical, it's a very basic exam. That doctor really doesn't, he kind of just looks at you and you know, that's kind of it. I mean, he'll blood pressure. They'll do some, you know, the hearing check, you know, they'll do vision tests, but it's not like it's difficult to pass that test, really. So for ALPA to come out and say, oh, we don't want to share the skies with medically unfit pilots, I think that was a little bit of an overreach. At any rate, it kicked off a period of compromise that changed the rules, but not so much that it made it that untenable that we don't want this. So one of the things that came out of it was the 10-year look-back period. Originally, as written, it would have been just for anyone who ever held a medical. So you could have held a medical 25 years ago. You'd be okay. But because of ALPA's statements, there was some compromise that was done, and one of the things was this 10-year look-back period. And really, the rules that emerged after it was all said and done, they're really great. I mean, you can fly up to 18,000 feet. You can fly up to 250 knots. You can fly day or night. You can fly VFR, IFR. You can fly with up to 6 seats in the airplane. When they were originally talking about this, it was going to be, I think, you know, 4 seats, VFR only, no night flight. And so the rule, even with ALPA's objections to it, the rule that emerged after Congress got involved and after the compromise was done, it really is a great rule.
Max T, Steve tells us that he's flown with the Garmin G1000 NXi. Tell us, what is that?
Well, so the original Garmin G1000 came out back around 2004 and really it became the go-to standard for most small light aircraft. The G1000 NXi, which was just announced about the first of the year, basically upgrades the processor tremendously. It's a dual-core processor now instead of single-core, so that means that some operations can happen in parallel sometimes, which speeds up the overall computing process. It's got higher contrast screens, better resolution on the numbers. It's got a few other features in terms of the way you can display mapping information on the main flight instrument display underneath the HSI, which is the kind of the compass display, if you will. It's on the flight display. So it's got a lot of features that are just basically an upgrade that was needed. You know, you figure a dozen years is a long time in the avionics world or any electronics world. So it was kind of time for a refresh.
And Steve, how was it to fly?
Well, I was shown G1000 NXi back in November at the NBAA convention. And at the time when I saw it, it was on a test bench. And I looked at it and I said, I know that this is G1000, but it was just different enough that I felt a little uncomfortable. It was familiar, but it was vaguely intimidating. And then a few weeks later, they sent a King Air 350, which was the first airplane that Garmin had. It was what they did their testing in. And I got a chance to fly it. And once I flew it, I realized pretty quickly that, you know, any pilot who's familiar with G1000 and knows G1000 well will have absolutely no issue transitioning from G1000 to G1000 NXi. And then it was a few weeks after that Cirrus has their new SR22 G6, Generation 6. It's the 2017 model. And it has Perspective Plus avionics, which is a follow-on to Perspective. And it's based, of course, on G1000 NXi. And I got the chance to fly that airplane over the course of 3 days. I flew it from New Jersey down, landed for fuel in Charleston, took off again, flew down, landed at night in Miami, flew from Miami the next day down to Marathon Key, spent a couple days there doing some photo flights for a cover story in the upcoming issue of Flying Magazine, and then flew back from there and actually landed at Atlanta Hartsfield International, so the busiest airport in the country, which was pretty neat. And it was really on those flights that now I say, I want this avionics. I've got Perspective in my Cirrus. I want Perspective Plus. Those processors make the avionics 10 times faster. That's really a big deal as far as panning, zooming. The displays themselves are much more vibrant, much crisper. But where the real value of the new avionics comes is in the ability to add additional features. And it's kind of features you didn't even realize you wanted until you see them and you say, oh my gosh, I need that. So I'll give you an example. We were flying down to Charleston, and there were really powerful storms moving across Georgia and South Carolina. And they weren't to the airport yet, but they were very close. And of course, which direction are these storms moving? Well, in Perspective Plus, now instead of seeing a static view of Sirius XM NEXRAD radar imagery, they have the ability to animate the NEXRAD imagery, just like you do on your cell phone when you're sitting there looking. And you think, well, of course they should be able to do that. Well, they couldn't do that in the older version of G1000. They just didn't have the computing horsepower to do it. Now they do. And so I could see these storms sliding past the airport. And it actually made me realize not only that I would be okay getting in there, but it made me decide that I was going to land to the east instead of going to the west. Even though the wind very slightly favored a landing to the west, I decided to go to the east because I could see the movement of the storms. That's a really great thing to have. Same thing flying back out of Charleston, flying to Miami, seeing the movement of the storms, I could pick the path that would take me directly across the weather as quickly as possible because I knew which way that the weather was moving. So that was really cool. Just a lot of great features. It's got a new vertical situation display that's really cool. It has the ability, it tells you when you're on frequency, it'll tell you with the little data tag who you're talking to. So it'll tell you you're talking to approach control, which is good because, you know, if you forget, then you just look there and you can see who you're talking to. On the flight down to Miami, it was kind of interesting. Woke up in the morning and there was a 400-foot overcast layer, and I figured it would burn off. It was just a very thin layer. Figured it would burn off by the time we got out to the airplane, got ready to go. Got out there and no, sure enough, it's still this 400 overcast layer, and we're ready to go to Marathon Key, but we don't have an IFR flight plan in the system. So we called up clearance delivery, just sort of thinking, hey, you know, can we get an IFR clearance just to get out of here? And they said, no, you have to file. So, you know, I'm thinking, you know, 10 years ago, this would be a hassle, you know, to be able to file a flight plan. But we were able to use the Garmin Pilot app to put in a flight plan that got us out of there. And we were able to beam that flight plan right into the avionics using the Garmin Connect technology and have it in the avionics ready to go in our flight plan. Less than a minute after we signed off with clearance delivery, we were calling them back to say we're ready for our IFR clearance to Marathon Key. And it was just moments after that, cleared as filed, ready to go. And I just sat there like, this is great. I need all this technology. I don't have the ability to beam a flight plan from my phone into the avionics. Boy, I wish I did.
Yeah. And United wish they had that capability last night too.
Yeah, they could have used that.
I'm not an expert, certainly, on avionics, but just kind of a general question. I mean, maybe Garmin, but also perhaps in general. Do these manufacturers provide regular updates, firmware updates, that sort of thing? Or is it pretty much, you know, they sell you a product and that's the way it works? And if you want additional capabilities, then you have to wait for the next product.
No, yeah, that's one of the great things that software allows you to do. They can add new features to the avionics as they go along. And, you know, the biggest example of that would be adding, as Garmin did, adding synthetic vision to G1000. There was a version of G1000, an older version that had hardware in the beginning that couldn't support synthetic vision. But then once they went to faster processors, not as fast as in G1000 NXI, but they went to faster processors, then they were able to add through a software update synthetic vision. There's been some safe taxi technology that they've been able to add. So they're constantly able to roll out new features, new technology into the avionics. But they just got to a point with G1000 where the old hardware, they just knew that, you know, it's Moore's law. You know, electronic capability doubles every 2 years. Well, G1000's 12 years old. So they just got to the point where they couldn't add in the new capabilities that they wanted to, which are the capabilities that they had introduced, some of them in G3000 and Garmin G5000, which are up in the turboprops and the business jets. They couldn't bring those to G1000 because they just didn't have the computing power there. So by going to dual core, by increasing the memory, a huge increase in memory, now all of a sudden they've got that power behind the scenes. So they've added in all this technology. And they've got plenty of room for growth. They're going to be rolling out technology in G1000, NXI, I'm sure, for many years to come. And it'll be things that, you know, we can't even guess at. Garmin knows what some of those things are, and they'll create new things as they go. But there's a lot of room for growth now in the new system. And that system is going to be rolled out eventually in every new airplane that comes with G1000. And the old version of G1000 will go away.
All right. Before we move on, I want to make sure that we just touch on a few aspects of Flying Magazine. Steve, I understand that you're partway through a redesign. What's that all about? What was the motivation for that?
Well, when I took over as editor-in-chief, the very first directive I was given was that we were going to do a complete redesign of the magazine, the look of the magazine. We were also going to change content of the magazine. We were going to completely redo our website, redo our e-news product. And it was really, you know, just a realization that the magazine needed to be updated. It needed to be able to compete in a changing media landscape, compete against digital products, some of which exist, some of which maybe don't exist yet, and to really position us for the next, you know, 20 years. And I would say that that change is the biggest change in the history of Flying Magazine. You know, going back, we were founded in 1927. We were founded just a couple months after Charles Lindbergh's solo Atlantic Crossing. And it was really to capitalize on the frenzy from that. And the magazine, you know, it started out as a general aviation publication. I'd say the second biggest change was when World War II, the outbreak there was a change where we just had to, you know, the focus, because they weren't building general aviation airplanes. Well, if you want to exist, you need to write about military airplanes. So that was a big change. But I would say just the biggest organic change would be the one that we've just done. And it's been a change, as I said, in the look of the magazine, but also in the content. We brought in a lot of new content. We've left a lot of the content that our readers really enjoy, but some of it just really didn't make sense to be in a monthly magazine. You know, a lot of the news type driven content. Now we have our website. We can use our website and our e-news for the breaking news, because if you have a monthly magazine and you're trying to do news, you know, by the time it shows up in your mailbox, it's 6 weeks old.
Right, sure.
And people, you know, people have read about it online. So it really just didn't make sense. And so we're really positioning ourselves for the future. And actually now we did a redesign of the magazine last March. We're actually tweaking that with the April issue. We're doing kind of another, it's sort of, if it was 1.0, maybe this is 1.1. And it's the content is the same. The look will be very familiar. We're just tweaking some things and making, and it's really for readability. And I think it's going to be a big improvement.
Well, I think the website is fantastic. I mean, it's clean. It's
thank you.
Easy to navigate. It's got a lot of useful information. I guess, well, maybe even more than that, it presents a lot of different stories and topics and makes it easy to kind of scroll through and say, okay, I'm interested in this. I'd like to find out more about that and get right to it.
Thank you. Yeah, and online will continue to be more and more of an important part of who we are as Flying Magazine. There will always be a print magazine, you know, in this market, which is it's very specialized. Market. If you want information about flying, if you want to read that flight report, you want to see that cover story on the new Cirrus SR-22, you're going to go pick up Flying Magazine. People still want to have their print magazine, or you know, the same thing but on an iPad. That's popular as well. That will continue to exist, but we also foresee our online growth being a very important part of our strategy in the future. And so the website redesign, I wouldn't even call it a redesign. It was just giving us a very powerful website that we can do some really pretty incredible things, interactive type features. We can do long form journalism with some really beautiful imagery on there and photography. So I'm really happy with the website, and I'm really excited about what we can do with it into the future. And I would say, you know, in 5 years, what we're doing online will be, you know, it'll be much heavier of an online presence even that we have today. But you shouldn't think that that means that the print magazine is going away, because it's certainly not.
Yeah, it sounds like you have a vision, and it's a good vision for the times, and you're executing it. Just one last thing, and this has almost become a sort of a standard question that we have, but for those listening who maybe see themselves as someday doing aviation journalism, writing for Flying, or someone who wants to grow up and be just like Rob Mark. Any tips, any suggestions, any
you
advice?
You need curly hair to start with.
You know, the first thing I would say is that if you have a passion for aviation And if you can write well and you enjoy writing, then I would absolutely recommend pursuing aviation journalism as a career path. And that is a very selfish thing for me to say, but the fact is we need aviation journalists. We need new blood. We need to bring in young people who I think, you know, quite frankly, they aren't thinking of aviation journalism as a career choice that they would pick over, you know, over some of the other career choices. And I'm not exactly sure why that is, but I do know that we need new blood. We need to bring in fresh faces. We need fresh perspectives. We need younger people to come in. So I would say absolutely go for it. And what I would say about the job itself is it's got to be one of the most fun jobs anywhere in aviation. And I think that's really saying something, because aviation has, you know, a heck of a lot of really fun jobs, you know, but the chance to hop in a Cirrus and fly down to the Keys, or as Rob did, fly over to Germany and fly the Remos, or he was just over in France and flew the Falcon 8X with Dassault, and I'm sure he had some nice dinners over there. It's a really fantastic job. It's really fun to do, and I would hope anyone out there who's listening, who has a talent for writing, is passionate about aviation, you know, at least think about it. And you don't have to do it as a full-time career either. There's a need for freelance writers. It's a part of the industry that's very dynamic. It's really fun going to the shows, covering the industry. It really is a terrific career path, and it's one that I'm really glad that I found myself on.
Wow, what a great story. Stephen Pope, editor-in-chief, Flying Magazine, Rob's boss. That must be a challenge in and of itself, but we'll leave that for another time.
Listen, the good news is that we have Pia Bergqvist to help balance things out. She gets in between if there's a difference of opinion.
If I'm back on the show again, you can just refer to me as Rob's boss. I like that.
Yeah, I thought that was Nancy, but okay.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody has a couple of bosses.
Yeah, I think so. All right, Steve, thanks so much.
Thanks for doing this, Steve.
Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
I was going to say one thing that's been really fun is that, you know, I was listening to Steve, and I learned quite a bit, actually, every time I listened to Steve talk, because initially I thought he was kind of a quiet guy when I met him when, you know, we were both working at Aviation International News Magazine. But he has so much knowledge.
Doesn't he? Wow.
Thing Max Truscott threw him, he went, oh yeah, and did you know that the guy did this and he went there and in this year he did, and I went, holy smokes. Yeah. The guy is really very, very smart. But, you know, he mentioned that it's a lot of fun, and it really is, because I can remember years ago, this is a long time ago, reading Peter Garrison, who's a technology guy in Flying Magazine. He was building his own airplane at the time I first
started. Oh, what was the name of that? It started with an S. Melmoth, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember he went, to Japan with it?
Yeah, and he built his own airplane, but it wasn't a kit. It was, you know, the guy, he has an engineering mind, and actually, I don't even know, maybe he is an engineer by trade. I don't know. But he's been writing for Flying for a long, long, long time and really does some great stuff. And here I'm sitting here a couple of weeks ago, the first time, looking at manuscripts coming across the desk that I have to give the first edit to. And I look and it's, wow, it's Peter Garrison's column. And I'm thinking, whoa, I'm going to edit Peter Garrison's stuff the first time. Whoa, this is so cool, you know. But
wouldn't have been fun to have Gordon Baxter's stuff come across the desk.
Yeah, I knew Gordon. He was a good guy. I'm sorry. Oh. But it's like that. There are these characters in aviation that we think just kind of appear, but they actually create their own persona, really in the magazines that they appear in. And so that's why I agree with Steve. I don't think Flying as a paper magazine is ever going to go away.
Interesting. All right. And now we have an aviation minute from Rob. This is a look at the Ariane launch and aircraft tracking.
I just had a couple of interesting brain thoughts here after the launch of Ariane and something that we talked about coincidentally tonight about the long-range tracking of airlines or airliners and business jets. So anyway, so just roll it, Max.
From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute.
It was ironic today when I heard the announcement that the search for MH370 had officially been called off, nearly 3 years after that Boeing 777 disappeared on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. I measured that against the accolades being shared at Ariane's headquarters in McLean, Virginia, over Saturday's successful orbiting of 10 new Iridium satellites, the ones needed to begin creating the first global aircraft tracking network. The idea of knowing exactly where on Earth the airplanes we purchase tickets on are actually located at any given point in time is a no-brainer conceptually. In fact, if you tell international travelers, for instance, that while out over the ocean or in remote areas of the planet, their airline has only the tiniest notion of where their airplane's precise location is, they'd be shocked. The airlines essentially know where their aircraft should be, but as we've seen with the loss of MH370, the word should and are translate into two very different views of the world. So thank goodness for Ariane's foresightedness back in 2011 when they began the effort to create the network that's expected to become operational by summer 2018. And no thank you at all to most of the airlines around the world that haven't lifted one finger to improve the tracking of their airplanes since the loss of MH370. Oh, sure, there have been meetings and proclamations and opportunities through companies like Inmarsat and FlyHT, and certainly ICAO jumped into the discussions, but not many airlines actually signed up to use any of those tracking technologies. The reason? Why, that's simple. Money. The airlines didn't think they could justify the cost of aircraft tracking systems to shareholders. But, of course, let's be patient. We can't forget that the poor airlines have to make money to stay in business. I guess some of us traveling bumpkins, though, are still naive enough to think that the airlines that are all too happy to grab our money might also be thinking that looking after us a bit more when we're their prisoner, sorry, I meant guest, might actually turn into a little value-added service. Guess not. From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark. And don't forget to follow us at jetwine.com for more industry opinions and analysis. We'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks for that, Rob.
You're welcome.
So we invite everybody to look for the Aviation Minute on iTunes, subscribe, and you'll also find it over at jetwine.com. Right, Rob?
That's correct.
Perfect. All right. Let's do a little quick what's up with the geeks. Let's see. Who's got something? Max West.
Oh, I'm so excited. I've been working on something for 10 years, and I accomplished it last week. So one of those long-term goals. I started teaching in the Cirrus actually just slightly over 10 years ago. Did the factory training up at the factory in Duluth and got the CSIP certification.
Tell us what CSIP is. I think I used to know, but I've forgotten what CSIP is.
Sure, that's the Cirrus Standardized Instructor Pilot, and I probably got one of those letters wrong, but or Instructor Pilot. I'm sorry. There we go. Yeah, so it's basically a certification for people who have spent about 3 days at the factory learning all the ins and outs of the Cirrus, which is important because, you know, there are a lot of let me put it this way. There's a wide variety and quality of instructors, and if you find a CSIP, then at least there's some baseline threshold of knowledge about the aircraft. But they also have what's called the Platinum CSIP. You need 1,800 hours in the aircraft. And last week, I got my Platinum CSIP certificate. So I spent the equivalent of about a year in the right seat. figure a 2,000-hour work year. Yep. But it's fun. It's still my favorite aircraft. I've flown about 85 different types over my flying career. Love the Cirrus. It's just so much fun.
Wow. Well, congratulations. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
How long did it take you to get that 1,800 hours?
So a little over 10 years.
Yeah, wow, that's a lot of serious time. Whoa, it's good.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it?
All right, Brian, anything on your side?
Oh, I just wanted to update everyone on all the cities I've been to. So since the new year, San Francisco, Las Vegas, New York City, Washington, and tomorrow I'm back up to San Francisco. So the joy for me continues. Hopefully in February I'll be going back over to Germany and hoping to get together with our listener Hendrik when I'm over there, and or anyone else in Hamburg that wants to get together. But I don't have confirmation on the dates yet. They've only talked about sending us over to Germany. So as soon as I know exact dates, I'll update everyone on that. Gosh, so much for me taking it easy in 2017. Just not working out that way. But the good news, though, so far, all the flights on United, all the flights have been relatively on time, within 2-3 minutes. Coming back from D.C., yeah.
You can't ask for more than that, really.
Service has been good. Coming back from D.C. the other day, we had such strong tailwinds, get to the airport a little over an hour early, which on a cross-country flight, they were really good tailwinds. But of course, there was no gate, so we sat on the tarmac for 45 minutes. We still got to the gate early, but it was just frustrating sitting on the ground for 45 minutes until they could open up a gate for us.
I was just in D.C. myself, probably for different reasons than you.
Yeah, mine were all work-related, so no museum watching for me. What were you doing in D.C.?
I went for the Women's March on Saturday after the inauguration. Myself, a couple of thousand guys, and about 200,000 or 300,000 or 400,000 women.
I like that ratio. That's amazing.
It was quite an event. It there was a lot of interesting folks speaking there. There were a lot of different perspectives. Different people were there for different reasons, which to my way of thinking was kind of indicative of the fact that there really are so many different opinions in this country, so many different viewpoints. And right now it seems like most parties are just spending a lot of time yelling at each other instead of talking to each other and figuring out something collectively. But it was really quite an interesting, unique experience. I'm really, really glad my wife and I went.
That's awesome. And, you know, I think sometimes we all lose focus on who the enemy is, and it's not anybody here in the United States. You know, it's you know, a few other little corners around the world. So anyway, you know, I just want to say I've been to 49 states. You know, I've loved all the people I've met in all the different places. And, you know, I think sometimes people do lose a little perspective on the big picture, which is, hey, we shouldn't be fighting among ourselves. Just remember who the enemy is. And right. It's not the folks within our borders.
Yeah. Yes.
Which state are you missing out on?
Oh, you'll never guess. So I'll tell you. Montana. I have flown over it, but I haven't actually been in Montana.
Huh. It's a beautiful state.
All right. Micah sent in a recording titled God Bless You, Gene Cernan. Now, we're going to play this, but first, Micah, you'll hear him preface his story by acknowledging the motivation for recording it, and he also offers a disclaimer for any inaccuracies. He does that, then he begins, God bless you, Gene Cernan. So here is Micah.
Before relating this to you, I'd like to offer a brief acknowledgement and a quick disclaimer. First, I need to thank Ray Davis, a listener in the Sydney, Australia area. He and I were chatting via Twitter when the news came in about Gene Cernan's passing. I was lamenting his loss when Ray said, "It sounds like you have a story there." That's when I realized I did. Secondly, I need to defer to our historian, David Vanderhoof, and friend of the show, NASA historian, Bill Barry, regarding any inaccuracies. Some of the history I'll relate here may be apocryphal, but it's how I remember it. So without further ado, here's what I call God Bless You, Gene Cernan. Not sure what to say exactly. The last man on the moon just died. Now both the first and last are gone. We're fortunate enough to have some in-betweeners left, 6 to be precise. But these men are both literally and figuratively a dying breed. Yes, Gene Cernan is dead. At just less than 83 years old, the last man on the moon has left Earth for his final flight. This one goes west. I didn't really expect his passing to affect me like this, but it did, and does. Another childhood hero is gone, and one whose name may not be as well known as some others, but a man I've always admired and respected. Sure, I was saddened when we lost John Glenn and Neil Armstrong. Jeez, I was upset when Wally Schirra passed. I mean, I'd once met Wally Schirra, had him autograph a box of Actifed for me, which made him laugh out loud. But still, there's something about Gene Cernan's passing that just leaves me melancholy. I always wanted to meet Gene Cernan, had hoped to do so one day. Everything I ever heard about him from people that knew him said he was a real mensch, a stand-up guy, a pilot's pilot. I heard him talk, watched him on TV. He knew he was good at what he did, and he also knew he was lucky. He suffered a bit from survivor's guilt. He felt awful that his compadres from flight school were flying off carriers and sometimes losing their lives in Vietnam, while he had a cushy job with NASA. Cushy job? Yeah, sure. He started his career in 1958 when he became a naval aviator, flying the FJ-4 Fury, which if you think of as a carrier version of the F-86 Sabre, you wouldn't be too far off. After the Fury, he moved to the A-4 Skyhawk in attack squadrons 126 and 113. When he finished there in Miramar, he then completed his education in 1963 at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School with a Master's of Science degree in Aeronautical Engineering. It was then he became a part of Astronaut Group 3, the 1963 astronaut class that included Buzz Aldrin, Al Bean, and Michael Collins, among 10 others. Cushy job. He flew Gemini 9A with Tom Stafford in command, a disaster of a mission in so many ways, but one we learned a lot from. The prime crew, Elliot C. and Charlie Bassett, died in a plane crash, leaving the backup crew, Stafford and Cernan, up for the flight. The first launch attempt was scrubbed due to a computer glitch, and they lost a launch window. Then their docking target's payload fairing failed to separate, so the planned rendezvous and docking had to be aborted. And then there was the EVA, a spacewalk. Gene Cernan completed a 2-hour EVA that almost killed him. His spacesuit cooling system just couldn't keep up with his body temperature. His visor fogged up. He couldn't see. He was only able to get through it by regularly clearing small parts of his visor with the tip of his nose. At one point, his heartbeat rose to 180 beats per minute. Overheated, and with a racing pulse, the flight surgeon, monitoring from the ground, was sure Cernan was going to pass out. But he didn't. But do you know what the bravest thing of all was? Remember, this was only the USA's second spacewalk, and was in fact the third ever in history. Cernan knew going into it that when he left the tiny cabin of the Gemini spacecraft, and I mean tiny, think a bit smaller than the front seat of an old Volkswagen Beetle, well, Cernan knew that he might not make it back in. He and Tom Stafford also knew that NASA might not survive the bad publicity if Stafford had to cut Cernan loose to save himself and the spacecraft. So they agreed ahead of time that if Cernan could not get back into the capsule, they would make the reentry with the astronaut still tethered by his umbilical, even though it would have resulted with them both dying. Talk about the right stuff. Some cushy job, huh? Cernan flew Apollo 10 as lunar module pilot, paired again with Tom Stafford as mission commander. John Young was the command module pilot. This was the flight before Apollo 11, the first one to land on the moon. The mission's primary objective was to test the lunar module and calibrate its guidance system by bringing it less than 9 miles from the lunar surface. There was a crazy part to this mission, too. NASA knew what hotshot pilots both Gene Cernan and Tom Stafford were, and being that they were so close, given the opportunity, they might just land on the moon. So NASA purposely short-fueled the LEM. NASA made sure that these pilots knew if they set down on the moon, they wouldn't have enough fuel to return to the command module on Earth. Thinking about it gives me shivers and makes me smile all at the same time. Then came Apollo 17, Gene Cernan's last spaceflight and our final flight to the moon. For 3 days, Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt lived on the moon, walked on the moon, drove on the moon, and prospected on the moon. For 3 days! And then they left. Gene Cernan's footsteps are the last ones on the moon. But before leaving, he did something very special. Before climbing into the lunar module for the last time, before saying the final words of man spoken from the moon, we leave as we came, and God willing, as we shall return, with peace and hope for all mankind. Before saying that, he wrote with his finger in the dust on the moon the initials TDC for his daughter, Teresa Dawn Cernan. Gene Cernan witnessed and was a major part of the greatest days of NASA. But then he lived and died during what may be some of NASA's worst times. I just feel awful about that. Look at how far we've come and how far we've drifted back. No one has been to the moon in 45 years. The USA no longer has manned spaceflight capability. We're back to being happy when rockets don't explode on a launch pad trying to lift a satellite into orbit. It's like we're back in the 1950s again. And what did we get from the space program, some ask? Sure, those who depreciate NASA say, I use butter anyway, I don't need Teflon, or I don't need a computer in my pocket so exponentially more powerful than those found on the Apollo missions that it's not worth comparing. But think about some of the other things we have. Personally, I've had several magnetic resonance imaging scans, better known as MRIs, that have allowed doctors to see the tissue and joints inside my body without cutting me open. Likewise, I've had joint repairs and soft tissue repairs completed by doctors without opening me up. For heaven's sakes, I've watched along on color high-definition TV as a doctor shoved a tiny camera up my, well, shall we say, fluid into some highly restricted airspace to check to see if I had colon cancer, and while there, removed anything that might become cancerous. So we can say that NASA and the space program has helped keep us alive and well. Gene Cernan fought to get us back on the moon. He fought for more NASA funding. He testified before Congress. He wrote books. He made films. He did what he could. But it was beyond even his abilities. Here we are in a world where the USA has no manned space capability. But thank you, Gene Cernan. I know if I thanked you in person, you'd say, I was just doing my job. I'm sure of that. But your job meant a lot to me, and still does. Thanks for doing your job. And in this, your final flight, please keep an eye on us if you can. For the Airplane Geeks here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Wow.
Yeah. What a great tribute.
This guy just continues to amaze me. And I remember, my God, how many years ago was it that we met Micah when Harriet was still around and we had her on the show? How many years ago was that?
Was that five, maybe? Something like that. We met him at Uvarhazy.
Wow. Yes. Micah, nice.
How about seven? It was 2010.
Was it 7 years? Oh, that's amazing.
How time flies when you're having fun.
I know, and we are having some fun, and we really enjoy knowing Micah and also benefiting from his recordings, his stories. Always fantastic. But this one felt sort of extra special to me. Great job, Micah. Thanks so much. All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to wrap this one up. We want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. As we say, we have a lot of fun doing this. Hope you have as much fun listening to all of us. We want to thank our guest for this episode, Stephen Pope, Editor-in-Chief, Flying Magazine, a.k.a. Rob's boss. You can find Flying... Well, Rob, we should let you do the credits.
Steve Pope, a.k.a. my boss. Find him at flyingmag.com or in the pages of Flying Magazine. He gets to write the editorials. I mean, those are kind of cool, actually. Hey, be sure and watch very soon for this cool. He told me, I'm going to take the Cirrus down to Marathon, Florida. And I went, oh, yeah, well, that would be nice. Well, he kind of skipped on the part that it was a brand new Cirrus G6 with all these cool electronics and they were going to do air-to-air photos. He kind of left that part out when he told me what he was doing.
Oh.
And then I heard about it when he got back, and I went, whoa! So I agree with him. He's got a pretty fun job.
Very good.
But you'll find him at Flying Mag, like you find me at Flying Mag and at Jetwine as well. And I don't know. Who knows? Here, I guess, too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Max Prescott, where do folks find you online?
Well, I want to thank folks for contacting me. I've had, I think, two listeners in the last week have contacted me to set up times to fly when they're in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I've told them that we have 10 different Cirrus aircraft to choose from, and people have taken me up on the offer. So you can go to SJ Flight, short for SanJoseFlight.com, and contact me through there.
Good. And David Vanderhoof, tell us how we can find you.
I need to wake up is what I really need.
You need to wake up. Have you been paying attention, David?
I have. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. And, of course, you can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
Good.
Oh, and on Thursday, on Friday mornings on that other show with Max Flight, the UAVDigest.com.
That's right. And Brian Coleman, how do folks reach you?
Oh, still in 2017, I'm not being social, so the best place to get a hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com.
All right. Find me. Let's see. Where can we find me? We can find me here at, as David mentioned, the UAVDigest.com. Also at PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby, at Max Flight on Twitter. Look for me on LinkedIn. And, of course, our listener Slack team, where we have lots of great conversations going on. You can find us at AirplaneGeeks.com. Show notes for this episode are at AirplaneGeeks.com/436. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Find him at brunomassone.com. So we'll ask all of you to please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Sure, it's up on iTunes.
Okay, that's what I thought. It's been so long, I can't remember. So
I knew you were going to say that.
So let's.
You just can't help yourself, can you?
I know, but I'll take all that out.
A little vacation. You know, I need a little time off. I was a little stressed.
That's fine. That's fine. So yeah,
I'm not stressed anymore.
No, exactly.
I'm better now.
Nancy, where are you?
Yeah, quick.
Bring out the meds.
Quick.
No, I don't need the meds. The check engine works fine.
We need the guys in the white suits.
Yeah, there you go.